Today on Against the Grain, in the popular imagination, U.S. anarchism ended with the deportation of Emma Goldman in 1919, only to reemerge recently with the massed Black Bloc. But according to scholar Andrew Cornell, anarchism survived and even thrived in mid-century America, deeply influencing Bohemia, civil rights, and the New Left. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with him about the lost history of 20th century anarchism. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The history of American anarchism, as it tends to be told, is one of heated class struggle in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, then repression and collapse. In the late 1960s, a very different kind of politics raised aloft the black flag. The histories of the broader left repeat the same claims, if they even bother to include the history of American anarchism in any depth. In them, the relationship between anarchism and the rest of the left, as well as anarchism and the wider society, are frequently left unexplored. In Unruly Equality, U.S. Anarchism in the 20th Century, published by the University of California Press, educator and organizer Andrew Cornell aims to upend these assumptions. He's also the author of Oppose and Propose, Lessons from Movement for a New Society, and I'm pleased to be joined by him today. Andy, there's a widespread presumption that there was a dead period for anarchism between the classical period of anarchism that ended around 1920, some might say 1940, and the blossoming of contemporary anarchism in the late 1960s. Before we turn to the period in the middle of the 20th century, which is, in fact, the main focus of your book, can you describe for us broadly the general contours of these two periods of anarchism, which are seen to be quite different from each other?
Well, when I think of classical anarchism in the United States, I think of a period running from sometime in the 1880s to the early 1920s, as you mentioned. And really the focus of anarchist activism at this time was class struggle. It was fighting for economic justice. And the group of people who participated in the anarchist movement, for the most part, were working class people who were working in industry or in extractive industries such as mining, forestry, agriculture. And the vast majority of these people were recent immigrants to the United States, the majority from Eastern and Southern Europe, some from Mexico, some from other parts of the globe. I think those anarchists did collaborate with some native-born U.S. Americans, and by the 1910s or so, they started broadening some of their ideas and focus. When we think about famous anarchists such as Emma Goldman and some of her collaborators like Alexander Berkman or Harry Kelly, they were starting to do a lot of work around women's issues such as reproductive justice issues, around free speech, around artistic modernism. But those were really kind of additions and more recent directions for anarchism to go, whereas the real focus had been on trying to overturn capitalism and create a kind of form of economic equality in a kind of stateless cooperative society. So we can compare that with more contemporary anarchism. I think the image that often comes to mind of contemporary anarchism is of black blocs, is generally younger people who are involved in street action. But of course, contemporary anarchism is a real, there's a variety of what people are doing. And struggles against economic injustice are certainly still a part of that. But I think feminism, queer politics, trans politics, anti-prison organizing, a huge focus on environmental sustainability, environmental politics, anti-racism, anti-police brutality. And I think for a long time in the 80s and 90s, a large focus of contemporary anarchism was on cultural alienation, trying to think about ways of having a more authentic, nonconformist culture and that being a big focus. And when you look at who's involved in contemporary anarchism, we see, I think, big shifts. Of course, it's complex, and there are a lot of people from a lot of backgrounds who are involved in anarchist politics. But a common stereotype is that anarchists are young people, generally often the majority white in many anarchist communities, of middle-class backgrounds. And so, you know, there's a demographic shift that I think goes along with a shift in what some of the areas of focus of activities are and some of the strategies and kind of tactics that people use. So there's a big change over the course of the 20th century.
And in your book, the book in question being Unruly Equality, U.S. Anarchism in the 20th Century, the focus of half the book is actually about the final stages of the period of classical anarchism. So I wonder if you could talk about that, the decline of what was a mass movement associated with groups like the Wobblies, involved in sometimes extremely heated conflict with the ruling class, with the state, and yet that started to unravel in the context of World War I. How would you characterize the latter stage of classical anarchism and the reasons that spurred its decline?
As far as I can tell, I think the kind of high point numerically of anarchism in the U.S. was in the 1910s. And that was because anarchists were really interacting and working through the industrial workers of the world, a revolutionary union, as well as participating in all these other sorts of politics that we've been discussing. And it's hard to know how many were involved, but readership of anarchist periodicals at that time was upwards of 100,000 newspapers circulating a month. And so there could have been many more. So it's hard to say, but certainly in some communities, this was a mass phenomenon where whole families and neighborhoods were involved and saw that anarchism, saw it as the way of the future and had a real sense that revolutionary change was possible and would probably happen within a decade, you know, certainly within people's lifetime. And I think that moment, that period of anarchist struggle really was checked and went into decline around the First World War, as you said. Anarchists, for the most part in the United States, opposed the United States' entry into World War I and the war itself. They saw it as a conflict between imperialist powers, where wealthy people fought one another for resources, but they forced working people to do the actual killing. Anarchists, as well as others on the left, socialists, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, some feminists and some pacifists, all resisted the U.S. joining the conflict. And this gave a whole array of enemies of anarchism a chance to really crack down on the movement. They did that in a few ways. The Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 basically banned criticism of the U.S. government and of the war effort. And the government was able to crack down on anarchists by banning their publications from the mail, from arresting people who gave speeches. And they kind of paired that legislation with anti-immigrant legislation that allowed them to deport people simply for holding radical views, whether or not they had taken any specific action against the government. So there was a wave of governmental repression, and that was followed by or in collaboration with vigilante attacks. So the Ku Klux Klan and other right-wing citizen groups would actually ransack anarchist social halls or the offices of newspapers. And so there was a general crackdown, and many people who had been in unofficial leadership roles, editors of newspapers, people who gave great speeches, were thrown in jail. So I think that was a big part of it. And that story has been told fairly regularly the story of the Red Scare of 1919. But another aspect that I think is really critical that I discuss in one chapter in the book is that there was a broader process happening of how the working class in the United States was constituted. There's big shifts that happened around World War I. Many of the immigrant workers from Europe were called back to Europe or went to fight in the war. Just at the time when factories needed many workers to create tanks, planes, armaments. And so there was a shifting wherein formerly racist, exclusionary employers started to call upon African Americans, who up until that point had, the majority of whom had been living in the rural South, started to recruit them to factories in the North, what's known as the Great Migration. And so you start to see a changing workforce in the factories in the North. And I think that prior to World War I, anarchists had not been great about specifically confronting white supremacy and specifically working to recruit and kind of spread ideas of anarchism amongst African Americans and other people of color. And so they really weren't able to adjust to that in the post-war period. So that was a real challenge.
That's the voice of Andrew Cornell. He's the author of Unruly Equality, U.S. Anarchism in the 20th Century. That's published by the University of California Press, and we're discussing it today. My name is Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain. Now, also in this same period, following the repression that you were detailing in the 1920s, and then, as you say, the shifts in the composition of the working class in the U.S., then, of course, came the Great Depression and the New Deal. And one of the things that you argue in Unruly Equality is that in looking at the history of anarchism, it needs to be looked at in the context of wider movements, societal changes, and ideas of the time, and the way that anarchism was both influenced by those and influenced them in turn. And I wonder if you could talk about the context of the 1930s in particular, with, on the one hand, communist left, which had taken a particular turn, and then on the other hand, the response to all the social unrest of the 30s from the state in the form of the Social Democratic New Deal.
So in the early 1920s, as anarchism was declining, the communist movement in the United States really began to take off, seeing the Soviet Union at that time as a big success story. Many radicals in the United States who maybe had sympathy for anarchism as a strategic orientation and vision before World War I put more energy into building the Communist Party USA. Socialist Party had a hard time through the 1920s and 30s as well. But I think anarchists really struggled to rebuild after that Red Scare. They didn't have a good labor strategy because the IWW was in decline and not a lot of energy in recruits. So they were kind of struggling through the 20s. And then in 1929, when the Great Depression hit, I think they weren't really positioned well to think about how to make best use of this intense social crisis happening with a economic crisis. Communists moved quickly to build unemployed councils, to develop a whole range of popular front organizations, so organizations that were progressive and were controlled by people involved in the Communist Party, but that didn't explicitly name themselves communists. So a variety of ways of pulling people into mass social movements. Anarchists at the time were kind of split. Anarchists have generally, because anarchists have tended to group themselves around journals that put out a specific kind of analysis and strategy. And I talk about the fact that there were a couple important journals coming out in the English language in the 1930s. One was called Man. It was published from Oakland, California. The editor was a man named Marcus Graham, supported by some Italian anarchists. And this was a pretty insurrectionary anarchist paper. And by insurrectionary, I mean that these anarchists were not very supportive of the idea of building revolutionary labor unions or other formal organizations and accumulating members. They had a lot of faith that when times got so tough, working people would revolt somewhat spontaneously. They didn't need clear leadership or an organization, but they would revolt in a way that may be able to really crack the social system in one go, and then they'd rebuild society. At the same time, there was another organization called the Vanguard Group that was based in New York City, and this was a more traditional anarcho-syndicalist group. They supported the industrial workers of the world and wanted to rebuild that organization, and they believed that anarchists could make the biggest impact by recruiting people into revolutionary unions that could fight for reforms as they were amassing numbers and would at one point stage a general strike and a revolution to overthrow capitalism later. But neither of these newspapers and the organizations that helped to build them were able to attract large numbers of people in the 1930s. There's not a lot of evidence that they did much more than hold forums and discussion groups and argue for policies, but didn't have a lot of organizational muscle at the time.
Well, one current that was quite strong in this period in the late 30s, often forgotten now, was pacifism. What was the trajectory of that movement, and how did it relate with anarchism?
Yeah, I think that's right. The way that anarchists connected with pacifism in the 1930s most directly was through the emergence of a new organization called the Catholic Worker Movement. Catholic Worker was started by Dorothy Day, who had been an active socialist and journalist before World War I, and an immigrant from France named Peter Morin. And they really pushed a number of anarchist ideas. They were very much influenced by Peter Kropotkin and by Leo Tolstoy, a pacifist Christian anarchist, the famous writer Tolstoy. They were also influenced by a tradition of progressive Catholic thought called personalism that Morin brought with him from his youth in France. But these folks really created what I guess you could call a kind of anarchist direct action service model that we see, perhaps we see reflections of today in groups like Food Not Bombs. But in the 1930s, when you had millions of people out of work on the streets, the Catholic Worker Movement was trying to basically to say that anarchist principles and the Sermon on the Mount by Jesus Christ pointed to the same things, this kind of do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. We need to look out for each other, and we need to do that directly rather than suggesting that the government should be responsible for things like welfare. So the Catholic Worker Movement would do protests, but they also set up houses of hospitality where they would give a shelter to people who are homeless. They'd feed them, and they created some rural farming communes. They said if people are out of work, they shouldn't try to fight to have more wage labor, but they should start to move towards being self-sufficient and farming for themselves. They were absolutely pacifists. They opposed World War II, the entrance of the U.S. into World War II. But in the 1930s, they weren't all that connected with anarchists. Anarchists were traditionally atheistic, anti-clerical, and so it wasn't until the 1940s and 50s that the Catholic Worker started really engaging with traditional anarchists.
Another place during this time that anarchists found a home was, perhaps surprisingly, in avant-garde art and literature. We spoke earlier about the culture of classical anarchism, but a lot of that was, although there certainly was an avant-garde component, a lot of it was very much rooted in more popular working-class culture. Can you tell us about the importance of the avant-garde for this kind of mid-century anarchism, which you have looked at extensively in your book Unruly Equality?
I think that we really start to see a transition between that more classical period and the characteristics of contemporary anarchism beginning in the 1940s, especially during and immediately after World War II. So there's a shift that happens. I think the groups I mentioned before, MAN and the Vanguard Group, had dissolved by the time the U.S. entered the war, and but a new generation of younger anarchists took up the mantle. And these were very small numbers: a dozen in New York, a couple dozen in San Francisco, a few sprinkled throughout the rest of the country. So this is a movement that's really holding on by a thread at this point. But those small groups of individuals, I think, were really starting to take it in some new directions that would be influential. So around World War II, the younger anarchists, especially some that published journals called Why, W-H-Y, question mark, and another one called Retort, put less focus on organizing workers in the workplace, and they started to make connections with radical pacifists, such as the Catholic worker movement that I just spoke of, but also with a variety of avant-garde artists. So these are people such as the poet Kenneth Rexroth, based in San Francisco, Robert Duncan, Philip LaMantia. These were other Bay Area poets. Back on the East Coast, the writer and poet and playwright Jackson MacLowe, Paul Goodman, who was a novelist, the kind of painter-poet Kenneth Patchen, and eventually the founders of the Living Theater, Judith Malina and Julian Beck, so people who are doing avant-garde, off the kind of initiators of off-Broadway theater. And what they found was a commitment to radical pacifism, to challenging this kind of new post-war culture. So kind of poverty was less of an issue in this golden era of U.S. capitalism, at least for white workers. There was a rising standard of living, but this is, of course, the time that is stereotypically known as an age of conformity, of McCarthyism, of moving to the suburbs and that kind of blandness. And I think that these writers were speaking out against a lot of that. Henry Miller published the book called The Air Conditioned Nightmare. That's how he described post-war U.S. society. Others just felt a real sense of disconnection. They felt the rise of consumerism, advertising industry, and so a kind of falseness that was creeping into American life. And I think that's what a lot of the artists were writing to.
Well, it's apt that this interview is taking place on the Pacifica Network, which was founded by anarchists 67 years ago at KPFA Radio in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they were, in some ways, I think, perhaps not representative, but similar to thinkers that you're talking about, and you do talk about Pacifica Radio in your book. They had been interned during World War II, and their pacifism obviously is reflected in the name of the network. Close to Kenneth Rexroth, had a program on KPFA in its early days. But they also identified as anarcho-syndicalists. In thinking about the continuities and breaks, or at least dislocations, of anarchism from the late 19th century into the 21st century, do you see then that this was a pivotal moment where classical anarchist concerns really retreated? And although there might be some elements from it, such as what I've just mentioned with self-identification as anarcho-syndicalist, that really what we see is a shift in the whole culture of anarchism that in many ways was rooted in major shifts in post-war American society?
Absolutely. So what I say in the book is that there's no absolute break where anarchism changes wholly and suddenly. There's a kind of crossfade of emphasis. We never lose the emphasis in anarchism on economic inequality, but just that some other issues come to the fore. And I think that you, around the mid-20th century, the 1940s and 50s, you start to see a demographic shift in who, people of what background are participating in the anarchist movement. You're absolutely right. I think one of the most exciting things about the moment of the 40s was the ways in which anarchists connected with pacifists around World War II. There was a division in the movement. Many anarchists said, fascism is such an absolute evil and such a threat to the left internationally, and of course to Jewish people and homosexuals in Europe, that we have to kind of forego our traditional anti-militarism and support the Allies in crushing fascism so that there might be a chance to rebuild anarchism later. But some of the younger anarchists in Retort and Y and connected with the Catholic worker movement said no, there should be resistance to fascism, but it should be independent of these big state militaries. And some of those folks decided that they couldn't participate in the war, and that they would either go into civilian public service camps or into federal penitentiaries as draft resistors. The public service camps had been set up by religious-based pacifists, and they were maintained. They were camps that would do work of building national parks or having people work in psychiatric facilities, so it was an alternative service to the draft. They were run by traditional pacifist churches such as the Quakers or the Brethren, but a whole variety of people ended up in them. Anarchists really connected with radical pacifists in this process. They were thrown together in these service camps and in prisons. And a lot of the pacifists that were coming in were bringing in what were then new ideas of Gandhianism, of nonviolent civil disobedience. And there's some amazing interactions that happened where these religiously based Gandhian Christian pacifists and anarchists collaborated together to resist the racial segregation of federal penitentiaries and to resist some of the impositions in the public service camps. They made friends and they started to influence one another's ideas, and they came out espousing a new kind of politics of revolutionary nonviolence. And that really tried to connect traditional anarcho-syndicalism with some of these Gandhian tactics and morals, you could say ethical behavior. One of the big, I think the clearest institutional attempt to institutionalize those politics was with a group called the Committee for Nonviolent Revolution, which was composed of a variety of folks who had gone through this draft resistance process. And many of them did see themselves now as pacifist anarcho-syndicalists. And people involved with that helped set up Pacifica Radio. They helped establish some of the important left-wing bookstores in the Bay Area, such as City Lights and Cody's and Kepler's Books down in Menlo Park. And they became involved with the War Resisters League and other radical pacifist organizations.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Andrew Cornell about his book Unruly Equality, U.S. Anarchism in the 20th Century. That's published by the University of California Press. He's also the author of Oppose and Propose, Lessons from Movement for a New Society. And we're discussing U.S. anarchism, particularly in the mid-20th century, between the bookends, as they have been frequently framed, of classical anarchism in the early 20th century and contemporary anarchism today. You mentioned the War Resisters League, and I wonder if you could talk about the role of anarchism within the civil rights movement and the Black freedom struggle.
As I said, during World War II, anarchists connected with radical pacifists to fight against racial discrimination in the prisons. They saw it very directly in that experience. And as they got out of prison, I think the anarchists that were involved in this new direction of revolutionary nonviolence thought that defeating white supremacy was one of the principal priorities that they should undertake. They certainly still believed in economic equality. They also found that after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, trying to fight against nuclear war and nuclear weaponry had to be a priority. But I think this was a period in which anarchists really started to place a greater focus on the ways that white supremacy and racial inequality played out in American history and to prioritize that. So through the auspices of groups like the War Resisters League, the Congress of Racial Equality, a group called Peacemakers, a variety of anarchists did get directly involved. For example, anarchists in the late 40s decided they would try to take over the executive committee of the War Resisters League so that they could push for a more far-reaching form of pacifism. In doing that, they decided to hire Bayard Rustin, important African-American pacifist and direct action strategist, as an organizer for the War Resisters League, and then sent him as an advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when the Montgomery bus boycott broke out. This was important because Rustin had almost been kind of drummed out of the radical movement because he was discovered to be gay and was caught having gay sex, and others in the more religiously based radical pacifist movement worried about what impression that would make, especially in the Red Scare and Lavender Scare years of McCarthyism. But I think one thing that's important and overlooked is that the anarchist pacifist milieu of the 40s and 50s was had a number of gay, lesbian, bisexual individuals involved in it, and it was something of a haven. And the War Resisters League, with many anarchists on its executive board, wouldn't let Rustin go. And they kept him in the movement, and he became a crucial part of the civil rights movement. They also helped to form Liberation Magazine. One of the major movers and shakers there was David Dellinger, one of the people that had been imprisoned and kind of came out of prison an anarchist during World War II. Roy Finch, Rustin himself was very close to these folks, and a variety of other people. And Liberation served as an important venue for debating strategy, whether that was pacifism, armed struggle, et cetera, in the Southern civil rights movement.
So after being in many ways in the wilderness in the 1950s, the ideas of anarchists like Paul Goodman, whose 1960 book Growing Up Absurd became a bestseller, a kind of key influence on the emergence of the new left, millions of copies sold. What shifted then from the 50s to the 60s, and how should we understand the ways that anarchism manifested itself in the 1960s in the new left?
Yeah, I think it's complex. I think anarchism was an influence in a variety of features. And the New Left itself was this movement of movements, as the historian Van Gogh has called it. That's a term that anarchists use for more recent movement upsurges. But you have to think about the various tendencies within it. One important place that anarchists had an influence was within the youth counterculture. I think the organizations we talked about, such as Pacifica Radio, the bookstores in the Bay Area, a variety of art galleries, had really been important seedbeds for creating this kind of youth counterculture of the late 50s that we know as the Beat Generation. Definitely influenced people like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. And that carried over into the 60s in what became a more explicitly radical and revolutionary counterculture. So there were these young folks who were invested in poetry, more open sexuality and starting to think about environmental issues and against the kind of stultifying 9-to-5 work environment. And in the 60s, they added a couple of elements into that thinking. They started thinking, kind of reading and connecting with European ultra-left thought. So groups such as the Situationist International that had a kind of artistic criticism of capitalist society. And they also were influenced by the Black freedom struggle and the radical nationalist movements of other peoples of color in the United States that had moved by the mid-60s beyond the focus on nonviolent civil disobedience, and to some extent was expressed in the series of urban uprisings. So I think all those things fed into a variety of groups across the country that were small but influential. The diggers in the San Francisco Bay Area that handed out free food in Golden Gate Park and created a store where everything was free. They articulated the concept of the free. In Chicago, the Rebel Worker Group, who were interested in beat poetry and surrealism, found jazz music to be revolutionary in content and form, and then really started kind of reconnecting with old IWW militants who were in their 60s and 70s. And then on the East Coast, you have groups such as the Black Mass Group, which later became called Up Against the Wall, that were pushing for a kind of artistic radicalism, challenging the ways that the Museum of Modern Art or the Lincoln Center in New York City upheld a bourgeois culture and served as kind of a mask over the brutality that they saw happening in the repression of Black and Puerto Rican radicals and in the bloodshed in Vietnam. So that was one way, the counterculture. I think there were also anarchist influences in Students for a Democratic Society. The idea of participatory democracy we could discuss as overlapping with anarchist ideas of self-governance. And then anarchists influenced the early women's liberation and gay liberation struggles as well.
Well, you've talked about groups that would have explicitly self-identified themselves as anarchist. And yet, also in the New Left, it appears that there were a lot of currents, let's say, that, would it be fair to say, didn't necessarily call themselves anarchists, but we could recognize them today as such?
I think so. It depends on how you want to define anarchism. But there was certainly an idea of cultural transformation that was present, a real shift away from a politics of organizing to a politics of what today is called prefiguration. So mid-century anarchists had put more investment in the idea that if you create alternative institutions and ways of life amongst a self-selecting group of anarchists, people try to live by their values, that will be an exciting model that other people will follow. They'll see that as preferable to the authoritarian society that they live in, and it can attract more people. People like Paul Goodman, who you mentioned, really thought that you could expand the realm of freedom amongst kind of a self-selecting group, and eventually it would draw other people to it and drain power and drain authority and resources away from the state and from capitalism. So that was a theory that was put out by this tiny group of anarchists in the 40s and 50s, but that came to the fore in terms of radical communes and other groups that tried to do that and kind of turned away from a strategic politics to one of if you build it, they will come. Had a pretty ambivalent real result. Certainly there was huge move into building food co-ops and radical bookstores and things like that in the 1960s and 70s that has had an abiding influence in culture, certainly on the West Coast and in certain parts of the country. But it never became a point where it was able to attract the majority of the people of the United States.
Sure. And I'd like to talk to you more about your reflections on the legacies of that whole mid-century period of anarchism. And I should say, though, that I'm speaking with Andrew Cornell. He is the author of Unruly Equality, U.S. Anarchism in the 20th Century. That's published by the University of California Press. He's an educator and organizer. And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. So in terms of thinking about the continuities that we can trace going back to the 1940s and bringing them up to contemporary anarchism today in the early 21st century, are there threads that you see that have been strengths and also weaknesses that come from then to now? You were just reflecting on the legacy of prefigurative politics and this idea that of building the new in the shell of the old and the limitations of that model. And that's certainly something that has come down to us today. One can see that current within the Occupy movement. Are there other currents as well that you can trace from then to now that you think have been thorny for U.S. anarchism?
Sure. Well, one of the kind of conceptual frameworks that I lay out in the book is that I say that there have really been three main strategic orientations within anarchism across the 20th and into the 21st century. They've changed a bit in what they look like, but they're still discernible today. So one way of trying to make radical social transformation is this prefigurative model that I mentioned, building counter institutions or living differently and trying to attract others to those projects. Another strategic orientation is that of mass organizing. And this was in the early 20th century. You could see this in the anarcho-syndicalist movement, in the anarchists that were involved with the industrial workers of the world. So it's this idea of going out and convincing other people of that change needs to happen, and that you can do that by building an organization and fighting for reforms in pursuit of revolution, to stage a revolution when you have enough people involved. And then I think the third major orientation has been that of insurrectionary anarchism. We talked a bit about that with the Paper Man in the 1930s. But this tradition says where there is repression, there is resistance, and that anarchists' role is to encourage that kind of uprising and insurrection. So showing that power is not, infallible and all present and always wins, but showing that you can, that everyday people can attack that power and hope that in doing that, more people spontaneously get involved and resist. So I think that today in contemporary anarchism, all of those streams are still present, but they often get kind of confused and mismatched, and anarchism can kind of pull against itself when people aren't clear which of those methods they're using. And I guess I'd also say that that anarchists, regardless of which of those orientations they put the most focus on, have always been focused on education and cultural creation, trying to really change people's minds, attitudes, ethics through artistic production. Anarchists have been great at that. I think that's one of their strong points. I think they're also great at inventing new and creative tactics that catch people's attention, that point out injustice. I think they're good at thinking about ways in which power operates, coercive power, and critiquing that. I don't think that anarchists have done all they need to do in updating their theories of understanding what the state is and how states differ from one another and how they function today under new conditions.
Right, and that's a particularly complicated one, right? Because one has seen the rise of contemporary anarchism more or less coincides with the rise of what might be called the neoliberal project from the mid-1970s to today, where the state is the ostensible object of shrinkage, although obviously that's actually much more complicated than the meets the eye. And so then when the welfare state is being rolled back, anarchists have been in a complicated position.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the biggest things that contemporary anarchists need to address and get their heads around. The 19th century anarchists were relating to the early onset of liberalism and the kind of first representative democracies that even excluded most working people from voting. They saw the state as absolutely an instrument, a tool, a weapon in the hands of the owning class. But modern nation states and representative democracies have changed over the course of the 20th century, somewhat affected by radical struggles of workers, of people of color, of women, of other excluded groups, fighting to use some of the resources and the institutions of the state to protect themselves and to try to hold off some of the violence that capitalism does. So contemporary anarchism is in a weird place in that you have a right-wing libertarians and neoliberals that are attacking the idea of a big government, of a big state. Like you said, they don't want to get rid of government completely, but they want to shift resources and policies away from those that do something to soften the blows of capitalism and white supremacy and build up the state's capacities to make war and to incarcerate and police its citizens. But if anarchists have a kind of blanket criticism that say states are all bad and we don't want to work through them at all, that can confuse people. They might not understand the distinctions between a kind of neoliberal criticism of the state and an anarchist one. And it raises real questions in terms of strategy. Do we defend public education? Do we defend state-supported healthcare as anarchists?
One of the things that you have been arguing in Unruly Equality is that anarchism needs to be understood, the trajectory of anarchism, in relation to the social context in which ideas and movements were shaped and shifted. And you were describing kind of a continuity from the 1940s to anarchism in the present. But of course, the social context in which anarchism flourishes now versus the anarchism at that time have really shifted. That whole post-war expansionist era of the general expansion of capitalism and of raising standards of living, at least for white people in the post-war era, that has changed pretty significantly. And in some ways, the present period, not completely, but has more in common now with the more brutalist period of the early 20th century. So could we expect then some more shifts in the coming years in contemporary anarchism?
I think so, and I think that we're already witnessing that. It's always hard to say who's involved in anarchism and what are the dominant characteristics, because you don't have institutions, specific organizations that have a huge longevity. There aren't often opinion polls done of anarchists. But I think that you can see a shift in the 2000s and the 2010s, a bit away from the focus that was dominant in the 80s and 90s when I first started learning about and participating in anarchist circles. There are a couple of French sociologists, Luc Boltanski and Yves Chapello, who have made a useful distinction between a social critique of capitalism, which talks about inequality and how people are excluded from decision making and from the resources they need to survive, and an artistic critique of capitalism, the idea that in bourgeois society. We live boring, meaningless, alienated lives where we're unfulfilled spiritually somehow. I think that really beginning in the 40s, in that period of when equality, economic equality, seemed like it was starting to dissolve, anarchists became some of the most outspoken and insightful proponents of this artistic critique of capitalism. They spoke to the way that culture was unfulfilling. But that really dragged on through the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, and that was, I think, an important focus of anarchist politics, the continuous focus on creating radical countercultures, the connection of anarchists and the punk scene, trying to look, express your politics through sartorial choices, what you wear, the color of your hair, et cetera, as a nonconformity kind of politics. Today, and the problem was that the social critique never went away, that there were still people in the 40s, 50s, 60s in the US and around the world who experienced enormous aspects of oppression and exploitation. But I think anarchists sometimes didn't forward those priorities as much as they should have. Today, that's becoming more and more evident, and the ways that police brutality works, the ways that we have just raging economic inequality, endless war. And so I think maybe the shift is going back to that social critique, but we need to it's not to discount the other, but I think in terms of priorities, that's where our attention needs to be and where we will increasingly see it in the anarchist movement.
Well, I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. Andy, thank you so much for your time today.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. It was an honor to be on the show with you.
I've been speaking with Andrew Cornell, educator and organizer, author of Unruly Equality, U.S. Anarchism in the 20th Century, that's published by the University of California Press. He's also the author of Oppose and Propose, Lessons from Movement for a New Society. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
Thank you.